You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heiser's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 273, Exodus 12, part 2b. I'm the layman, Trey Strickland, and he's the scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. Hey, Mike. What's new?
Well, I have started moving my library from my office this week, Trey. I'm about halfway, and it is a burden, let me tell you. I've got, you know, 3,000 or 4,000 books, and it's, you know, it's just me. I got to pack them. So they're going to sit in my garage in boxes for the next 6 months or so, and there we are.
Moving is no fun for sure. I hate moving. But that's why, yeah. Mike, it's called just digitize all of your books. There you go.
This stuff doesn't exist. Well, I work for Logos, so there I am pushing a card out to my car, and somebody, you know, from the office looks at me and says, you know, what's going on here? You know, you work here. Why aren't these on digital? It's because we don't have licenses to lots of things. So I probably have about 4,000 books, and I'll bet all but 200 of them are not in Logos format. I mean, a lot of the higher end stuff you can't get in Kindle or Logos format. I mean, I have some things in PDF. So if you count the PDF, you know, maybe 3,500 of my 4,000 books are in digital. But, you know, there's just no other solution. So it is what it is.
Sit in your library and just look at your books? I mean, you just sit there and just...
No. No, I sit in my office and work.
I
work, if you can call it work.
Marvel at the thousands of books of knowledge. And you've read every one, right?
No, a lot of them are reference books.
Yeah.
Because I can't, I mean, living it, it'd be a little different if I was in Wisconsin where I'm like 10 minutes away from a research library. That's not the case here. And it won't be the case, you know, in Jacksonville either. Right. So I can't depend on a local university library. We have a Division II school here, but they just have next to nothing, you know, in biblical studies and other areas that are important to me. So I'm more or less dependent on myself. But the journals are, you know, I have digital access to those, and that's my go-to, you know, tool: dissertations and journal articles. But, you know, a lot of, you learn about these books, and the journals reference books all the time. And so sometimes I'll buy them, sometimes I won't, but they don't exist in any other form, so there you are. The only thing I sit and marvel at my office is my portrait of Maury. You know, my drawings. I've had two people make drawings of Maury, so I can, you know, sit there and gaze at those. That's about it.
Yeah. Well, that's why we listen to the Naked Bible Podcast, because we don't have to buy 4,000 books. You know, we're going to let you do all the research and work, and we're just going to piggyback off your knowledge, if you don't mind, and just listen to the show.
Right. Yeah, well, that's true. What can I say?
Absolutely. I mean, that's the key.
I'll remember that when I'm pulling my cart, you know, out to the car.
And doing it for the people.
Picking up the boxes. That's right. Somebody has to do it.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, it's called Google. That's my library.
Yep, it's called Middle Earth.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Right.
Well, all right, we're just going to jump in and continue where we left off from last time.
Well, now, if you recall our earlier episode, there was an Egyptologist, a very prominent one, Donald Redford, who didn't buy that Ramses was a reference to the Pharaoh in Exodus 1:11. You know, we talked about Redford's skepticism in that earlier episode. He just doesn't buy into it. You know, Hoffmeyer opposes Redford's skepticism, naturally. That's no surprise. He doesn't think Redford is correct. He thinks it is Pharaoh, Ramses II. And Hoffmeyer cites other prominent Egyptologists that don't buy into Redford's objections either. One example is John Currid, and I've read from Currid's book in previous episodes. Currid is a late dater, and this is what Currid writes about this whole issue. Another problem in attempting to identify Ramses was outlined by Donald Redford in 1963. He argued that the biblical Ramses could not be the Delta capital of the Ramessides because the latter was called Per-Ramses in Egyptian texts. And he quotes Redford here, "Is Ramses to be equated with Ramses II's new capital?" Because in Exodus 1:11, it's just it's Pithom and Ramses. It's not Per Ramses. This is, you know, Redford is fixated on this. It's not the same name that you'd see in Egyptian texts, is Redford's argument. So it can't be the same thing. It can't be the same place. It's not named after the pharaoh. So back to Curd. Curd says, let me see. Do I want to include Redford? I'll include Redford's comment here. Is Ramses to be equated with Ramses II's new capital? The latter during the late New Kingdom bore the name Per-Ra-Mes-Su. And whence we would expect a Hebrew P-Ra-Amses. But biblical Ramses, that's not what we have. So the two names, Redford says, just seem to have nothing in common. Now back to Curd. Manfred Bietak, Curd points out, has adequately answered Redford's challenge by demonstrating on the basis of earlier work by Sir Alan Gardner and Wolfgang Helk, those are, again, two other very famous Egyptologists, that the Per of Per-Ra-Mes-Su does indeed drop off in various grammatical situations. And so Curd concludes that the abbreviated form, just Ra-Amses, could have easily transferred to another language. That's the end of the Curd quote. Now, he's citing Bietak, Manfred Bietak, and some of you may be able to get this book in case you're interested on Bietak's rebuttals to Redford. It's from an essay in a book. The essay is called Comments on Exodus in the book Egypt, Israel, and Sinai, edited by A.F. Rainey. That's R-A-I-N-E-Y. Now, that is available. Still, you can find it used on Amazon. So if you want that resource, you know, you can get it. Huffmeyer further argues, quote, "None of the geographical terms found in Exodus 1:11 and the root of the Exodus are known in Egyptian sources prior to the 13th century." Let me read that again. Huffmeyer says, look, the rebuttals to Redford's objections that Ra-Amses in Exodus 1:11 cannot be Ra-Amses the great, Ra-Amses II's, you know, royal residence, he says, those objections have been answered by other Egyptologists. The Per part of the name does drop off, and so the fact that it's just Ra-Amses in Exodus 1:11 is no rebuttal. And then he adds, I'll read it again, quote, "None of the geographical terms found in Exodus 1:11 and the root of the Exodus are known in Egyptian sources prior to the 13th century." Now that's pretty startling, because you'd think, again, you would think that wouldn't be true if we have an early date for the Exodus. Now, you could argue against Mosaic authorship for the Exodus accounting, and you could say, well, somebody writing after the 13th century, when these place names existed, could be using these place names to tell the story of Moses, but the actual event would have happened in 1446 BC. You'd actually have to argue against Mosaic authorship at this point to hold the early date. Now, Wood actually doesn't want to do either. I'm telling you what I think is the most coherent. Wood says, look, Huffmeyer says none of these place names, these toponyms, are in Egyptian sources from the 13th, you know, before the 13th century. That's an argument from silence. That's true. But again, to my ear, it's a little bit startling. You know, is that the same kind of argument from silence that we might object to in other things? Well, maybe it is, maybe it isn't. I don't know. But that's all that Wood says. And I know Wood, and he's not going to argue against, I'm pretty sure that he would not argue against Mosaic authorship to save the early date Bacon in this argument. Instead, he's just going to say that's an argument from silence. And that's what he does in his article. So I don't think he would go beyond that. So is that a good argument or not? Well, third item, Judges 11:26. Now, Wood takes this number at face value, just like he does 1 Kings 6:1. Let me read you the verse. This is Jephthah speaking, the judge. "While Israel lived in Heshbon and its villages, and in Aroer and its villages, and in all the cities that are on the banks of the Arnon, 300 years, why did you not deliver them within that time? Now, if you don't recall the context for, you know, what's going on in Judges 11, this is Jephthah, basically, I don't know if I want to say picking a fight might be the right way to put it, you know, with in the context of Moab, and he's saying, look, this is land, you know, that you know, doesn't belong to you, and so on and so forth. You know, Israel has been in this place, you know, this thing they're arguing about. We've been here for 300 years. Let me just pick up a few of the earlier verses. We'll start in verse 23. So then the Lord God of Israel dispossessed the Amorites from before his people Israel. Okay, the Amorites, again, this is another way of referring to the Rephaim specifically, but we'll just say the Canaanites here. It's a way of referring to the conquest. The Judges period is after the conquest, you know, under Joshua. So Jephthah says, hey, you know, the Lord, the God of Israel, dispossessed the Amorites from before his people Israel. Are you going to take possession of them? Will you not possess what Chemosh, your God, gives you to possess? I mean, you got your own lands. You know, Chemosh gave you those. This is ours. And all that the Lord our God has dispossessed before us, we will possess. It's our land. Now, are you any better than Balak, the son of Zippor, king of Moab? Did he ever contend against Israel, or did he ever go to war with them? Well, Israel lived in Heshbon and its villages, and in Aroer and its villages, and in all the cities that are on the banks of the Arnon, 300 years. Why didn't you deliver them within that time? Again, he said, may the Lord, the judge, decide this day between the people of Israel and the people of Ammon. So, you know, he's talking to the king of the Ammonites, and he's bringing up the king of Moab, he's bringing up Chemosh, you know, the Amorites and all this stuff. The bottom line for Judges 11:26 is that Jephthah says, and he's not the last judge, he's kind of in the middle. He says, look, we've been here 300 years. Now, Wood takes that number at face value. And if you do that, it requires there to be 300 years between the time of the conquest and the time of Jephthah. That would be logical. I mean, for him to say that and take it at face value, he's saying, look, today is like 300 years since the conquest. Now, this is Jephthah, and there were six more judges: Ibzan, Elon, Abdon, Samson, Eli, and we'll include Samuel here. He was the last judge. There were six more judges after Jephthah, before we get to the beginning of Israel's first king, you know, the monarchy, Saul. If we take the years of each of these judgeships at face value, we get from Jephthah to the life of Samuel, 103 years. So that means there needs to be roughly 400 years between the time of Moses, or let's just say, Moses' death. Let's just say that the time of the conquest, okay? There has to be roughly 400 years between the time of the conquest and the time that Saul becomes king. Now, if the early date is right, the conquest under Joshua wrapped up circa 1406. Let's just call it 1400. 1400 BC. 400 years puts us to around 1000 BC, which it's workable. I mean, that's roughly the date for David's kingship. I mean, we got to squeeze Saul in there somehow, you know, because Saul reigned 40 years, David reigned 40 years, and then Solomon, you know, gets there in 970. So, you know, we've got some number discrepancies there. We've got this 400 year period doesn't quite, you know, work, you know, just numerically. And, you know, people like Wood, who take this number seriously at face value, they say, look, we can fiddle with the numbers here a little bit because various judges could be and really ought to be understood as ruling concurrently. So we don't just take the numbers of the judges and string them one after the other. There were a number of judges that ruled at the same time, but in different parts of the promised land. So he's saying that, you know, some of this is going to overlap. And again, this is not really in dispute either. Everybody sort of recognizes this. So he's like, you can scrunch the chronology, you know, the beginning of the monarchy, the end of the conquest, and what Jephthah said. You can make it work if you want to take the 300-year number at face value. But then he turns it on Hoffmeyer in the late date and says, so how are you going to make 300 years work? If you have the Exodus occurring in 1267, and then look at look at the dates associated or the years associated with Moses. They wander around 40 years. Now we're down at 1227. And they get in the land. It's like seven, estimates are 7 to 10 years, for the conquest. So 1227, let's just call it 1220. You've got 120 years, okay, in theory, at least on paper, before the monarchy begins. But now you've got a 300-year number within Judges 11:26 to work with, to deal with, which is actually bigger. Again, if you add some of the judges, even if you take them as not linear, if there's some of these that are concurrent, you've got at least 300 years to compress into 120. How are you going to do that? So this is a big deal for the early date as well. Again, 1 Kings 6:1. They can live with the Septuagint in Exodus 12:40 as long as you don't impose math on it, a breakdown on it. And then Judges 11:26 is a big deal. Because, Wood would just say plainly, Hoffmeyer has a serious problem here. The late date has a serious problem. Concurrent judgeships might be able to handle a 100-year overshot, but you have an overshot problem of more than twice that length. What are you going to do with that? Now, Hoffmeyer responds this way. This is how a late dater would respond. Quote, a literal understanding of certain large numbers may not always be correct if the authorial intent was not literal. Such misplaced literalism would be a misinterpretation of Scripture's meaning. Thus, Jephthah's statement that the Israelite tribes had occupied areas of the Transjordan 300 years earlier, since the days of Moses, or at least the end of Moses' life, could be a case of hyperbole that is intentionally exaggerating the time in order to strengthen his dispute with the Ammonites. That's the end of the quote. So Hoffmeyer is saying, look, Jephthah's exaggerating just to pick a fight or make a point with the king of the Ammonites. We should not take this literally. And, Hoffmeyer is going to know, and we've had this discussion as well about the use of large numbers being hyperbole. But, let's be honest here. I think the legitimate use of hyperbole with large numbers, we talked about the large number problem. Those are terms when you're talking about tens and hundreds of thousands, not 300. Okay, so that to me, this response on Hoffmeyer, I said the response of Wood earlier about, the editorial updating with Zoan was weak. I think this is weak. This really strikes me as a weak response, just an exaggeration. I mean, he has to say that, but again, if I were a late dater, I'd want more than this. It just has the feeling of, what else can I say? Just like earlier Wood, that's how it makes me feel. What else can I say? So there you go. So the early daters, again, really, are going to push Judges 11:26 as being a number that we take at face value. Now you could also, to be fair to late daters, Hoffmeyer doesn't get into this, but you could say, look, Jephthah, really? We're getting information from Jephthah now. This is the guy who uttered the insane vow at the end of his judgeship and has to sacrifice his daughter. And I realize there's more than one view of that, but just work with me here. This is the guy that was such an idiot that he did that. Even in this passage, he refers to Chemosh as the god of the Ammonites. That wasn't their god. Chemosh was the god of Moab. It's in the Moabite stone. So Jephthah even gets that wrong. This is no scholar. He's a hack. He's just a judge and kind of a bad guy too, in the end, or a stupid guy. Yes, God used him, but he's a bit of a moron. So why should we take Jephthah's understanding of Israel's chronology seriously? He could just be throwing a number out there. And essentially, that's what Hoffmeyer argues. So you could dress it up a little bit, but at the end of the day, that's really, that's the late date comeback. If I was a late date, I would wish for a little bit more on that. I'd wish for something a little bit better. Item number four, the lack of external reference to Israel in Canaan earlier than the 13th century BC. Now, Hoffmeyer and other late daters argue that the earliest reference to Israel being in Canaan, in the Promised Land, the earliest external artifact, inscription, anything, the earliest external evidence we have for Israel even being in the Promised Land, which of course they would be after the Exodus, is the 13th century, specifically the Merenta or Merneptah, you'll see it spelled both ways, Stella. Hoffmeyer explains, and you've probably seen a picture of this. This comes up all the time, you know, with the Book of Exodus and just generally biblical archaeology. Hoffmeyer writes, one of the major problems for the early date Exodus is the early date conquest. As one who has extensively studied texts relating to Egypt's military activity in Canaan from the 16th through the 14th centuries, I have been troubled by two problems, Hoffmeyer says. First, among the records of the warring kings of Egypt who had imperial control of Canaan and Syria from circa 1500 to 1200 BC, except for the Merenta Stela, there is no reference to Israel or any of the tribes, despite the fact that several hundred toponyms are known for the region. Let me stop there. He's saying, look, Egyptian, you know, war chronicles, they use 700 place names from Canaan. I mean, they're familiar with Canaan, but there's only one reference, and it comes in the 1200s. There's only one reference to Israel or any of the tribes, just one. And so, you know, Hoffmeyer is saying, you know, that's a real problem for the early date. There's like nothing in the archaeological record about the people, while there is plenty in the archaeological record about the places. Sounds to me like the people aren't there yet, and that the early date just doesn't work. Now, Hoffmeyer continues, and he says, Wood points to a recently published inscribed block by Manfred Gerg, that's G-O-R-G, O with the umlaut, that is stored in the Berlin Museum as possible evidence of Israel's presence in Canaan in the 15th century. So, you know, let me stop there. Wood brings up an artifact, and again, you have access on the episode webpage to this article about this artifact. You know, Wood knows there's an artifact that has, in theory, and I'll just tell you, I think it is real, okay? I think it's legit, that mentions Israel in an Egyptian artifact prior to the 13th century, specifically in the 15th century where you need it for the early day. So Hoffmeyer says, Wood brings up this object and this article by Manfred Gerg. And he says, Gerg's reading of this name as Israel is plagued by serious linguistic and orthographic problems that preclude it from being Israel. I shall address four, says Hoffmeyer. And he does this in his article. I'm not going to get into hieroglyphs here and spellings and linguistic stuff, but you know, you can go read that and maybe you'll get something out of it, maybe you won't. But to continue with Hoffmeyer, thus the only occurrence of Israel from ancient Egypt remains the Merenta Stela. He doesn't think Manfred Gerg's artifact really says Israel. That's the issue. Does it include the term Israel or not in this artifact? And he says, this is certainly unexpected, you know, that we only have the Merenta Stela, since we possess scores of geographical texts and toponym lists and hundreds of extant toponyms from Canaan from the 15th and 14th century, and yet neither Israel nor any of the tribal names is attested. For the period 1400 to 1250 BC, Egypt exercised hegemony over Canaan and Syria, so this silence is problematic for the early date Exodus and the conquest. Now again, Gerg's article can be accessed on the episode webpage. It's actually co-authored with two other scholars. The names are Peter van der Veen, Christopher Thies, I'm not sure how to pronounce it, and Manfred Gerg, and the title is Israel in Canaan Long Before Pharaoh Merenta? A Fresh Look at Berlin Statue Pedestal Relief 21687. That's in the Journal of Ancient Egyptian Interconnections, and this is a freely available article on the internet. Now, Gerg has since responded to Hoffmeyer. Hoffmeyer is writing in 2007, don't forget. And so, you know, Gerg is aware of Hoffmeyer's criticisms that are in Hoffmeyer's article. So Gerg has since responded to Hoffmeyer in a follow-up article, which unfortunately is only in German. And that is Manfred Gerg, Israel in Hieroglyphen. That's in Biblische Notizen, which is a scholarly journal in biblical studies, but it's basically all in German. Way back in 2001. I mean, he and Hoffmeyer have been going back and forth before, you know, these present articles that we're citing. So Wood actually presents a summary of Gerg's points, his rebuttals to Hoffmeyer, in his article available on the episode webpage. So if you have the Wood article, you'll see Gerg's rebuttal to Hoffmeyer. Now, my two cents here, you know, since I you know, Egyptian is one of the languages I've had several years of. I think Gehrig responds well to Hofmeyr. Consequently, I don't think the notion that the Marentas Stella compels a late date for the Exodus, I don't think that's coherent at all. I think Gehrig's work and the work of these other two scholars is sound. I would say there really aren't any good linguistic problems with the spelling of what would be Israel in this pedestal. So I don't think Hofmeyr has a rebuttal here at all. I think Gehrig handles him well. But that doesn't mean anything for the debate. Okay, now we have one artifact apiece with the name Israel in both time slots, 15th century, 13th century. Will that really help? You know, well, I guess it helps, you know, rebut Hofmeyr's sort of insistence, you know, that, or his, the way he cast doubt on Israel being in Canaan. So it at least does that, but it doesn't, you know, flip the argument to, oh, we've got to be early daters now because of Manfred Gehrig. No, it doesn't do any of that. It just says, now we got one apiece. So take it for what it's worth. Number five, the Pharaoh of the Exodus. This is our last content item for this episode. So the question is, did he survive the Red or Reed Sea incident? And by the way, the Hebrew text does have Reed Sea, not Red Sea. Yam Suf is Reed Sea. And we'll get to the terminology when we get there. So the question is, the Pharaoh of the Exodus, did he survive what happened at the Red Sea? I'll just use Red Sea now. Basically, the answer to this question affects the number of possible candidates among Egypt's pharaohs as to who could have been the Pharaoh of the Exodus. Whether this pharaoh died in the sea or not, it would have been his firstborn son who died in the last plague. So it doesn't really matter if the pharaoh dies or not. You're going to have people take sides on that. What really matters is that pharaoh, did he lose his firstborn son? Another way of saying is, you know, whether he was killed or survived, who took the throne next? Was it, if it wasn't the firstborn son of the guy, you know, who either survived or died in the Red Sea, well, that's kind of interesting. You know, so the issue is really about the firstborn when it comes to deciding, you know, what pharaoh we're dealing with here. Again, early daters aren't married to whether pharaoh perished in the Red Sea or not. Wood believes that the pharaoh did die in the Reed Red Sea, and that this pharaoh was Amenhotep II of the 18th dynasty. And Wood argues his point this way. Here's what he writes. Hofmeyr doubts that the pharaoh of the Exodus died in the Reed Sea. A review of the pertinent text, however, suggests otherwise. In Exodus 14:18, the Lord told Moses that he would, quote, gain glory through Pharaoh, his chariots, and his horsemen, unquote. Then, after the Israelites had crossed the sea, quote, the Egyptians pursued them, and all Pharaoh's horses and chariots and horsemen followed them into the sea, Exodus 14:23. By the way, notice that it doesn't say Pharaoh's horse in there. Back to Wood. When Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, it returned to its place, quote, and the Lord swept them into the sea. He swept them into the sea. Psalm 136:15 uses the same language, but explicitly includes Pharaoh. So this is a little bit better. The Lord, quote, brought Israel through the midst of it, but swept Pharaoh and his army into the Yam Suf. Again, that sounds like Pharaoh's in there. The Egyptians were then engulfed in the returning waters such that the entire army of Pharaoh perished, quote, not one of them survived, Exodus 14:28, Psalm 106:11. So Wood says a clear sequence is presented in these verses. One, the waters are parted. Two, the Israelites cross on dry land. Three, the Egyptian army charges into the sea in pursuit of the Israelites. Four, while in the midst of the sea, the Egyptians, including Pharaoh, are thrown from their chariots as the waters returned. And five, the entire army is engulfed by the returning waters. Wood writes, it is highly unlikely that Pharaoh, the one the Lord would gain glory through after being thrown from his chariot, somehow miraculously escaped the massive inundation of the returning waters of the Yam Suf. A straightforward reading of the biblical text implies that all of the pursuing Egyptians, including the king himself, drowned in the Yam Suf. I want you to remember that line. Wood says that the Pharaoh of the Exodus drowned in the Red or Reed Sea. Now, another scholar, Douglas Petrovich, also likes Amenhotep II as the Pharaoh of the Exodus, but he doesn't think that Pharaoh died in the Reed Sea. And he doesn't see that as a problem for biblical reliability when it comes to these verses that I just, you know, sort of truck through here that Wood uses. So Petrovich rebuts Wood's use of these passages as indicating Pharaoh's death. And you can go read Petrovich's article. Again, that's also accessible on the episode webpage. So, you know, you got one early data that says Pharaoh died. Another one says he didn't. Petrovich rebuts Wood's use again of these passages, noting that none of them actually says the Pharaoh died. I mean, the one says the Pharaoh gets swept away, but, you know, okay. He further points out how Amenhotep's reign length, now here this is a bigger issue. Petrovich points out how Amenhotep's reign length, this is Amenhotep II, cannot accommodate Wood's early date defense if Amenhotep II died. Since Petrovich doesn't think he died, he defends the Amenhotep II identification by different means, zeroing in on the fact that Amenhotep II's firstborn son was not his successor. Now, Hofmeyr obviously doesn't think that the pharaoh of the Exodus was Amenhotep II, because his Exodus is like a couple hundred years later. It's a later dynasty. So Hofmeyr writes this of Wood's identification of Amenhotep II being the pharaoh of the Exodus. He says, there are several problems with this identification. First, Wood muddles Egyptian chronology by using the high chronology for the 18th dynasty. For example, he gives dates here. Amos, 1570 to 1546. Amenhotep II, 1453 to 1419. Wood uses the high chronology for that part of the 18th dynasty, and he uses the low chronology for the 19th dynasty, the next dynasty, dating Ramses II to 1279 to 1213 BC. The high chronology dates for that are a little bit earlier, 1304 to 1237. Now, let me stop here. You have to know there are two systems of Egyptian chronology. One is called the high chronology, which is dates things a little bit earlier, and the other one's called the low. So Hofmeyr saying is, you know, Wood's kind of cheating here. You know, to get Amenhotep II as his pharaoh, he uses one system for one dynasty and he uses another system for another dynasty. That's cheating. Hofmeyr writes, according to the now preferred lower chronology, the 1446 BC Exodus lands in the reign of Thutmose III, not Amenhotep II. Many evangelical scholars cling to the higher chronology because they have determined a priori that Amenhotep II has become their pharaoh of choice for the obstinate potentate that Moses dealt with. The second problem for Wood's Exodus pharaoh drowning in the sea, and this is, you got to pay attention, this is I think this is a good rebuttal by Hofmeyr. But again, it's just a pharaoh candidate. The second problem for Wood's Exodus pharaoh drowning in the sea is that the mummy of Thutmose III was found in the Deir el-Bahri cache, while Amenhotep II's mummy was actually discovered in his tomb, one of only a few royal mummies discovered intact. So Amenhotep II was intact. In fact, all the mummies of the 15th century are accounted for. According to the x-rays and investigations of these mummies, none indicate a death by drowning. Following Wood's logic regarding Ramses II, remember Wood had said Ramses II drowned in the Red Sea? Following Wood's logic regarding Ramses II, one would have to conclude that none of the 18th dynasty pharaohs could have been the pharaoh of the Exodus, because none of them drowned according to their mummy pathology. Now, this point by Hofmeyr, I think, is well taken. Drowning as a cause of death for Amenhotep II would be detectable by virtue of pathological inspection. Hofmeyr would argue, like Petrovich, that it's not necessary to say the pharaoh of the Exodus died anyway. So it's okay to posit Ramses II. You know, he's just saying, look, none of these other guys drowned. But, you know, Hofmeyr knows that, well, there's going to be people like Petrovich that don't have him dying in the Red Sea. So, you know, I'm not going to press the point too far. You know, I'm going to stick with my man, Ramses II. But he uses this to sort of dig at Wood. And it's a good dig. You know, it's a good rebuttal. But Hofmeyr, you know, again, he doesn't press it too far, but I don't want you to miss the point. So the real question, though, is what about the firstborn son? Now, this is interesting enough here. Ramses II was succeeded by Merenptah, or Merneptah, if you prefer that. But Merenptah was not his firstborn son. So Hofmeyr is going to argue, look, I've got a good candidate here, Ramses II. I got the name in Exodus 1:11. He was not succeeded by his firstborn son. Now, and I don't have to have him drowning in the Exodus, so we don't even need to worry about what, you know, the pathology of the mummy. And he's going to say, who's the Pharaoh for the early date? At the very least, you can't say he died because we have all the mummies and they've all been examined. So you're going to have to exclude that from your argument at the least. But in case of Ramses II, again, he was succeeded by Merenptah, who was actually the 13th son of Ramses II. And we know that from Egyptian texts. He was not Ramses II's firstborn. It's actually uncertain as to who Ramses II's firstborn was. I mean, he had like scores of kids, literally. And that brings us to wrap up, just as an Egyptological point of curiosity, KV5. You may not know any of this stuff about the pharaohs, but this is one of the reasons why it's a peripheral reason, I'll admit it, but it's one of the reasons why the discovery of KV5 was a big deal. This is back in the 90s, and I have a link to this on the episode webpage if you want to go back and read the New York Times article. KV5 was the tomb that was entirely underground. People had been walking over it for decades. And it's the largest tomb complex known for any in the entire spectrum of Egyptology. And this is the tomb where scores of Ramses II's sons were interred. It's discovered by Kent Weeks, who was an American Egyptologist. I don't know what's happened. It used to be you could actually go into each one. There was an interactive website called the Theban Mapping Project that appears to be defunct right now. I don't know if they moved it and called it something else. I mean, who knows? But you can at least go read the article. This thing is massive, and it has lots and lots of rooms. It's going to take decades to excavate because they're all filled in, and it's all underground. So it could be that we would find, again, if it's fully excavated, there may be the remains of Ramses II's firstborn son there. And then we'd find out who he was and maybe something interesting from hieroglyphs that might be there or something said about, who knows? But what we do know for certain is that Ramses II was not succeeded by his firstborn. That's the point of contact and the point of knowledge for our purposes. Again, that late daters are going to, you know, throw out there and say, look, we've got a good candidate here. Now, that's what we're going to cover for the date of the Exodus. Look, as we've gone through, I've given thumbs up to both sides at different points by virtue of this rebuttal is kind of lame. Okay? That means the other side has a good argument. So there are good arguments to be made on both sides. I've said that before in prior episodes, and now you kind of get a feel for why I said it and why I mean it. There are good arguments on both sides of this. For me, the most significant point, I think, has to be Exodus 1:11. If it's true that Ramses in Exodus 1:11 is Ramses II, then the debate is over. The late date is the winner. Defenses of Ramses in Exodus 1:11, you know, against Redford's objections, I think those objections against Redford are workable. Again, early daters are going to, you know, cling to what Redford says, but I think they're workable, but that doesn't mean that he's right or the rebuttals are right. I mean, ultimately, you know, who knows, but it looks like that is a really telling point. I mean, if you're not going to be a late dater, you've got to do something with Exodus 1:11. That's the linchpin right there. Now, as far as the editorial updating, because that's how the early date is going to defend itself against Ramses in Exodus 1:11 being Ramses II. I mentioned that I thought Wood's comeback to Hofmeyr on the updating question about Zoan was lame. It is. But I think there's something else going on that neither article mentions here. Okay, let me just throw this out. I'm not sure that formulaic language for editorial updating is required to have an updating. See, that's Hofmeyr's point. If you don't have the editorial language that, hey, we updated something here, that is, in other words, you know, if you don't have that, it's not an updating. I don't know if that's really true. And I'll give you an example. Genesis 36:31. Now, this is Genesis, okay? It says this. Let's see here. We have a section. These are the, back in verse 15, these are the chiefs of the sons of Esau. And then you get these genealogies, a whole list of names. And then in verse 31, we read this. These are the kings who reigned in the land of Edom before any king reigned over the Israelites. Okay, that very obviously, you know, and the names of the kings follow, Bela, okay, Jobab, and blah, 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 blah. The names don't matter for our discussion. The comment matters. Moses could not have written that because he's writing before Israel had a king. How would he know that these are the names of the kings who reigned in the land of Edom before any king reigned over the Israelites? That's a retrospective statement. That is an editorial comment by a later writer. And did you notice? There's no formulaic language in there. Now, I'll grant, this is what Hoffmeyer would say if he was, you know, listening in here. He would say, well, hey, that's not, it wasn't about toponyms. It's about kings. Well, that's true. That's true. It's not about toponyms. But it is certainly updated information. And consequently, for me, I think the updating question is still open. I don't think the formulaic language requirement of Hoffmeyer closes it. Because of passages like this, and this isn't the only one, you have comments like this in Scripture where it's very evident that a later hand is updating his readers with information in some way, and it's not always the same way. So you could say, well, you know, this is like a thesis topic. It's always the same way with toponym. Well, maybe it is, maybe it isn't. But is that a requirement? You know, it, like, is there a rule, some cosmic rule that says you cannot have any toponym updating without this language? I mean, who makes the cosmic rule? I don't know. So for me, the editorial thing is still on the table. It's still an open question, which is why I don't think that it's case closed for the late date on the basis of Exodus 1:11. I do think, okay, Redford's arguments have been answered pretty well. They're workable. But again, I think there's, for me, this point about the editorial updating, there's still some uncertainty there for me as far as it being case closed. I just don't think that's the case. One last comment. Having said all that, I still think there are problems with Egyptian chronology. And this is where, you know, David Roll and really not just Roll, because again, Roll gets a bad reputation. And in some cases, I think he deserves it because he says wacky stuff. Okay. But there are other parts of Roll's work that I find really interesting, you know, and I would use the word compelling in a couple instances, like yes, we definitely have a problem here that needs to be fixed. It's not just Roll. It's something called the Ancient Chronology Forum. If you think this is just one renegade Egyptologist guy named David Roll, you're wrong. There are scholars from all sorts of disciplines, astronomy, Mediterranean archaeology, Syro-Palestinian archaeology, Egyptology, okay? They were part of this group called the Ancient Chronology Forum. They published, you know, a journal for, I don't know how many years it was. I mean, it's defunct now, but most of it's online. There are a lot of holes in this. And a number of these holes, a number of these problems do affect the way Egyptian history and biblical history align. That's just the reality. I don't know who's right, you know, the quote-unquote traditionalist, you know, chronology people, or some of the Ancient Chronology Forum, the chronological revision people. I don't know who's right. And frankly, you know, neither do any of them, but they're making a case, you know, for changing the chronology of these areas in the ancient world, which affects the Bible and affects topics like this. They make cases. And some of the cases really, I think, deserve attention. Some of them, okay, Roll says nutty stuff. Good, you know, so what? What about the stuff that he says that isn't nutty? You're using his nutty stuff to excuse yourself from looking at it. That's just not good methodology. So I think there are still problems with the whole system that need resolution. Maybe they can't be resolved. I don't know. So it's because of this kind of stuff that I find this stuff interesting. But this, you hit a wall with chronology where you just say, for lack of a better way of putting it, a lot of this stuff is insoluble. And for me, I just wasn't going to spend any more time on it. I would rather do biblical theology in its ancient Near Eastern context. I think it's more interesting. I think it's powerful. I think it affects lives. I think it helps people become better readers of Scripture 100 times over more than a question like the date of the Exodus. And again, I don't want to denigrate anybody's work here because I benefit from their work. I think this whole episode is an illustration of how we benefit from people who do drill down. But I'm actually saying they need to drill down more because there are people who have and have produced serious problems that need to be addressed. And for me, I'm not going to be a chronologist. That's not my calling. It's not my career. You know, I'm going to go off and do what I do, like on the podcast and the stuff that I write in Unseen Realm, you know, biblical theology in light of its own ancient Near Eastern context. It's ancient context period. Israelite first century Jew. That's what I do. That's what I know I'm called to do to spend the hours that I have on, not this. So I've tried to tell you why, and at least, you know, give you an idea that, yep, there are good arguments on both sides. There are problems on both sides. So be warmed and filled. You know, pick the one you like. Just be noncommittal. It doesn't matter to me. But we're going to move on next week. We're not going to return to, you know, chronology. We've got other things, other, you know, fat to fry. We've got, you know, the Yom Suf crossing. You know, what does that mean? Where might it have been? What's the, you know, the historical and symbolic meaning of this? And there's a lot there. Trust me. Problems with the itinerary, the location of Sinai. We'll have to, you know, get into that at least once more. All that kind of stuff. But we're going to be moving on from chronology if we can help. I've decided, made an executive decision here. We're going to do Exodus 13, specifically verse 1 and verses 11 through 16, the consecration of the firstborn. And the question is, did Yahweh call for human sacrifice? Now, to many listeners, you may never have even heard that question raised, but the question gets raised because of those verses I just mentioned.
All right, looking forward to that, Mike. But before we get to Exodus 13, we're going to do a Q&A. We're going to pause, take a break, and yep. Do a Q&A before that. But we still want to hear...
I'm up for that.
I bet. We're way overdue for a Q&A, so we'll do that. Again, you can send me your questions at treystrickland@gmail.com. But we've got several in the queue already, so just know if you send me a question...
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, I was going to say, we're just not quite at the Exodus yet. We got one more thing to cover before we hit it. So I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's okay. No, it's great. It's good that you're covering these topics in depth. I mean, that's otherwise, where else are our listeners going to get this information? So we appreciate the thoroughness of it. And all right, Mike, well, we're interested to see where people come down on this. So please hashtag Naked Bible out there in social media. And get the conversation going, because we want to see, maybe we'll read some of the quotes and stuff out there on Twitter and Facebook and anywhere on social media where people are commenting, where they're coming down on this topic, because I'd be interested to hear what people's thoughts on that. Okay, Mike, well, again, next week we're going to do Q&A, and then the week after that we'll get into Exodus 13. And with that, I just want to thank you, everybody, for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.